I'm Ed the Sock, and this is FU Politics on Fun, the FU Network, powered by your support on patreon.com/FUNetworkTV and through PayPal at FUNetworkTV@gmail.com. Drop us a few bucks. Don't be a freeloader. And now, here's your show.
The Broken Clock Podcast is back, and we are talking about The Letter. If you have not heard of The Letter, that is okay. We will be your first exposure to it, which you're welcome. The Letter was a letter published, a letter to the editor, an open letter by a group of people. We're starting with collectivism this week. That was basically the beginning of an explosion of free speech among cultural elites about the restrictions on free speech among cultural elites. So there was one letter signed by quite a few people, but the names that sort of get picked out are J.K. Rowling, Noam Chomsky, Barry Weiss. The names that tend to get forgotten in the original letter are names like Fareed Zakaria. But this was responded to the open letter. Mouse and I talked off air, so I'm not speaking for him. I'm not speaking over him here, but we both sort of agree that the original open letter in Harper's was an experiment in strangely tepid pearl clutching by cultural and intellectual elites. Now this, of course, provoked a response called, this is all just Oscar Wilde's like fever dream.
Yes.
A more specific letter on justice and open debate, which was a more openly outraged experiment in pearl clutching by a differently polarized group of elites. And Mouse and I want to talk about these, because then The Atlantic wrote a piece by one person, Graham Wood. At least he was willing to go on the record with his name, unlike some of the alleged signatories to the letter against the letter. And he calls his piece The Cowardice of Open Letters. I invite everyone to read Graham Wood's piece so that we don't accidentally, you know, come up with some of the same ideas as him independently and make it seem like we're ripping him off. But what we basically have, well, Mouse, do you want to take a crack at kind of explaining your perspective? Because we can spend a whole hour just detailing the sophistic froth that is occurring here. Like, I don't want to sound too derisive, because at the core of this is, to be really, really simple here, there is a reductive binary here on both sides, not to invoke both sidesism, but in this case, a pox on all their houses, right? Except for Graham Wood, who bothered to speak for himself. You know, this idea that one must have open and unfettered public, quote unquote, debate, or one can have equality of opportunity and equality of platform for Black, Brown, and trans people. Like, have I misrepresented it here? That's basically the binary that these overeducated walking thesauri are creating here.
Yes. It's an interesting tactic that is being used in the letter. One of the things I noticed is basically the notion that unless you allow for all types of debate, and if I remember, the letter included, you know, caustic debate. If you do not allow for all types, then of course you have no freedom. Now, there is an issue in the letter, and as so many letters of its type, it did something that, give me one second, I have to adjust something.
For people who are I want to confirm that Mouse quoted the letter accurately. I'll read the paragraph he's referring to while he makes an adjustment. The free exchange of information and ideas, the lifeblood of a liberal society, is daily becoming more constricted. While we have come to expect this on the radical right, censoriousness is also spreading more widely in our culture. An intolerance of opposing views, a vogue for public shaming and ostracism, and the tendency to dissolve complex policy issues in a blinding moral certainty. We uphold the value of robust and even caustic counter speech from all quarters, but it is now too common to hear calls for swift and severe retribution in response to perceived transgressions of speech and thought. So that, I believe, is the paragraph Mess is referring to there.
That is indeed the paragraph. And
that was amazing timing. Did you see how we did that?
I know. It's like we're in sync or something.
That was amazing. For just putting on my broadcaster hat instead of a critical thinking hat, that was art. I'm sorry. Enough back pats. Please go on.
So the thing with that paragraph, and I think with the letter in general, is that I know it may not have been the intention, but I cannot help but see many of its paragraphs as disingenuous, because it does something that I always consider very telling, which is the dropping of context.
Yes.
When you drop the context, and for example, you say, censorious, immediate retribution, etc. Okay, well, let's sit back from to take a look. For example, as we know, one of the people who signed the letter and who made a great ado about signing the letter was the creator of the Horcrux Journal.
Yes, J.K. Rowling.
J.K. Rowling.
I understand the philosophical reasons for including someone like J.K. Rowling. I think, however, it was a tactical error if they actually wanted to persuade.
Right, because we have, J.K. Rowling is a woman who not only has used social intimidation against those who have opposed her ideologically, mm-hmm. She has become somewhat of a bully, but she even has gone to the point of telling journalists who have published articles about her over Twitter, unless you take this piece down, expect to hear from my lawyers.
Yeah. Well, she sued a fan who created a lexicon for her universe. She originally gave him permission to do it until he wanted to do a book about it. And then, no, she wanted to do her own book. So all of a sudden, we were always at war with Oceania. J.K. Rowling censors. J.K. Rowling, instead of taking the power of her trademark and the power of her copyright and saying, I am going to extend my copyright to you, I am going to grant this, therefore preserving my right to control my copyright, but allowing you to publish the book, she's like, oh no, so-and-so won't let me and so-and-so won't let me. But yes, she's the copyright holder. Yeah. You know, she's the one that stopped it. The lawsuit was filed in her name. And so this is the real problem with this whole thing. And I think you nailed it when you basically said, I'm shortening because this is a thing that could spawn for 5 hours. And we don't have 5 hours. So you basically nailed the fact that the original letter actually says nothing concrete in terms of presenting evidence to prove their case. It alludes to things. It appeals to emotion a lot, right? And it presumes the rightness of certain inherent assumptions to the argument instead of testing the rightness of certain assumptions to the argument. And to me, it's basically two broad categories of assumption. One is that there is some unique chilling of professional paid public discourse. And two, that this is new.
Yes. One of the things I was surprised was to see Margaret Atwood also signing the letter. However, we do have some reports that the signatories of the letter, many signatories, did not know who was signing, and many of them did not see the final form of the letter as well. So there's there are several layers of what the fuckery going on here.
Also, I kind of understand Margaret Atwood's position because she has been at war with certain anti-library members of various levels of Canadian government, mostly municipal governments. The Ford brothers, Rob and Doug Ford, Rob Ford, before he passed away, decided he knew enough to speak about public libraries when the man could not pronounce the word library. He said library. And so I kind of understand.
Maybe he was thinking of a place where you drink.
That would be accurate. That would be in character. Libations, I don't think he's aware of that word, but that was very good. That was excellent wordsmithing right there. points for style. But I can understand Margaret Atwood kind of knee-jerking, and Margaret Atwood is the type of intellectual that will say, I don't care if people go crazy, because people have tried to cancel her. I think this is an important idea. And I think a lot of signatories believed it was an important idea. They knew they were going to catch hell, and they really didn't care. But you are correct that some people said that not only did they not see the final draft of the letter, which I'm suspicious of, but also, you know, they basically said, well, if I knew J.K. Rowling was going to sign it, I wouldn't have. And I'm not sure what to think about that. I think that if you don't believe in a principle just because someone you don't like does, there's something wrong with your thinking.
Yes, pretty much. And see, that is the problem with the letter itself, that the material is so non-specific. Mm-hmm. And it is non-specific in a way that it's almost morally coward.
I agree with you, which, as you said, the counter letter calls out. And I think that, you know, it's odd that the counter letter is on such a teeny tiny, like theobjective.substack.com. That's a weird place to put it. But then the counter letter throws up a lot of straw men on
of
race, straw men on gender, straw men on you know, trans identities. And the fact that both sides of this elitist pearl-clutching brawl seem to think this is a zero-sum game, seem to think that either you can say whatever you want, or you know, and let racism and everything like that just run amok, or you have to crush all dissent, or else black, brown, transgender, genderqueer, so on and so forth, like the list is super long, as Dave Chappelle calls them, the alphabets, they will not be able to compete in the marketplace of ideas.
It's a very it's definitely a set of positions that lack a certain level of nuance, but my brain suddenly decided to recompile.
Okay, while you're recompiling, I'll
for a note, I did not sleep very well, so I almost overslept.
Yeah.
So I'm still I'm still kind of going through the boot up process.
Everybody, I think, is dealing with the heat right now. That's my theory about why these things tend to go crazy in the summer. That everybody's hot, everybody feels yucky, everybody has a headache, and people get cranky. And what do rich, privileged people do? And by this, I mean everybody who signed any letter here, because let's face it, the only reason your name means something, even when you claim you can't even put your name on it because it's covered by NDA. Yes, counter letters actually signed a letter without signing it.
Yeah.
I wish I was joking, like it's Orwellian. But all these people are privileged. All these people have a platform. All these people are not getting it. They are so removed from the day-to-day struggles of regular people that I thought it was important to talk about this, because I put a thing up on Twitter when it came up. A few people are like, are you going to cover the letter on my YouTube channel? And I know this is narrative. I know this is anecdotal, but background, I think, is really important in terms of framing where I'm coming from on this. The response was sort of mixed. Some people were like, no, it's going to go away. This is a tempest in the teapot. Other people were like, no, please cover it. The problem is my YouTube channel is a gaming channel. It really didn't fit there. It's perfect for this podcast. But the things I tend to listen to the most in terms of feedback are the things that people are afraid to say in public. And this very shy, unassuming trans woman who I've talked to, corresponded with on Twitter for quite a while, DM'd me and asked me if I was actually going to do it. And I said, yes, I'm planning to, but let me run something by you first. You know, is your concern the fact that it is sort of an either or thing here, that trans people can't have a say unless free speech is restricted, or things just have to run amok and even the most intimidating silencing tactics should be allowed because free speech? And she basically said, yeah, there's not enough nuanced, balanced attention being paid to the fact that if this thing goes to either extreme that each letter is advocating, there's going to be a problem, notably for trans people. And so I'm like, okay, there is actually an underlying issue that needs to be discussed here. And I will give the Harper's Letter credit for, forgive me for invoking a terrible cliche, starting a conversation here. You know? I just wish it was an actual conversation instead of, because my complaint with the counter level letter is in many ways, it adds credibility. That's better than proves. It adds credibility to the original letter, because the attitudes expressed by the counter letter are actually quite scary as well. You know what I mean?
Oh yes, definitely.
Like this idea that they instead of being totally vague in the original letter, they suggest potential references for things that were said, some of which are straw men, or I'm sure as the people in the counter letter would prefer, straw people, straw ex people. And they sort of, anything that they can't straw person debunk, they just hand wave away. The idea that academics, associate professors are being fired for sharing peer review papers that somebody doesn't like, for instance. And that is actually one of the more significant problems with the current zeitgeist. And I say this as somebody who heard from a colleague of mine that I actually recommended to a particular school that she recently, her contract was not renewed because they basically, quote unquote, lost her paperwork. And she's pretty sure it's because she dared to tell a student in her role as an instructor that their presentation was sexist. And so this is what people would go, oh, that's awful. You know, the example that I'm pretty sure the original letter was referring to was not that. It was the case of an assistant professor of psychology at Marietta College who keeps stepping into the very dicey idea of racial genetic underpinnings and intelligence, which is a third rail. And he's pretty sure that, which it's one of those things where he didn't actually say some races are stupider than other races. What he said was that there is a possible connection between geography and genetics that may contribute to some very real distinctions between people of different, I'll say DNA, not saying the word race. And of course, this offends people who believe that race is completely a social construct. And off we go. I mean, these are the things that people with very few real problems like to fight about, right? Because most people are just like, I just want fairness. I just want to believe that I'm getting a fair shake. That if I didn't get a job, I didn't get the job because I wasn't the best candidate, not for any other reason. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Like there's a real fundamental disconnect in that regard. And I mean, I know you've encountered elements in your own career that, you know, as a singer, opera is supposed to be about talent, but you have opened my eyes to the fact that many casting decisions in the world of opera are not about the ability to sing. They're about how a person looks, perceptions about what, you know, princes and sylphs and Greek gods and whatever's going on in Wagner look like. And this blew my mind, right? Because when people got really mad at me when they are making a live action Little Mermaid with a black lady as Ariel, and my argument was, well, I don't really care if Ariel's a redhead because her being a redhead wasn't the integral thing about the character.
Pretty much.
She could sing, right? She could sing. And so the important thing is who is the best singer in that very bright, wide-eyed, sort of vaguely naive view on the world that Ariel has. Mm-hmm. And so people got mad at me because I wasn't outraged. Now, you've had the opposite experience that you're perfect vocally, but people just don't like the way you look.
Pretty much. It's the whole notion of, well, we don't really think you look like a prince because you've got extra pounds on you. And of course, I look at some of the portraits from... Yeah.
That's the absurdity of it, right?
And I go, well, I'm not qualified because I apparently have a chin.
Which anybody who's gone to live theater, most people are sitting so far back, nobody can see details like that anyway.
Yeah, but yeah, that is definitely one of the issues plaguing opera right now. That's the whole notion of what the thing is about isn't really about.
Yeah,
in the eyes of the people who are currently managing it.
And most people are probably sitting here going, "What?" Because the layman's when the layman hears opera, they think two things.
Pavarotti.
Like big dudes or big women in Viking helmets, and Bugs Bunny cartoons. Right? People are just, what? When they
cross-dressing rabbits. Yes.
Yeah, like
or the wind.
When people hear the idea that like opera singers have to be skinny, they're like, this is not, I wouldn't go to the opera to see skinny people. I go to opera to see big people with big booming voices. Like, and no side is right there, right? Like it's all ridiculous, facile and surface. But the disconnect, I just bring up this example to show the disconnect between how elites look at discourse and how everybody else does. And I hate even using the term elite because it's so charged, right?
Yeah.
Like, so let's sort of break this down. I know you like to start from first principles, and I shouldn't say like, it is correct to start from first principles. So what do you believe is or are, there may be more than one, the indivisible first principles at play here? What is really the center of this debate?
Well, it's definitely an interesting, if we're going to speak about the two letters, I wouldn't call it so much a debate as a sequence of proclamations.
Fair.
And that is one of the main problems, the many underlying problems, in that there is no communication actually going on. We have two parties sort of posting, nailing their manifestos to the church door, but not really bothering to look at each other when they're doing that.
Well, the counter letter is looking at the original letter, but they're doing it through tinted lenses, right? It's a very class-based framework that sees everything in, well, anybody who signed that original letter is sort of temporarily engaging in whiteness, which people are like, what? How does Fareed Zakaria temporarily become a white guy? No, I'm not kidding. These are what these critical theorists actually postulate.
Right. And it's I mentioned the three languages of politics a couple of podcasts ago. And this is very much an example of what happens when you're stuck on the oppressor and oppressed axis of power, axis of conversation, in which there is really no other option than one side being the oppressed and the other side being the oppressors. The problem with subscribing to that axis is that oppression kind of becomes a hot potato.
Yep.
The only way, if you operate on this level, the only way in which you can solve the problem of oppression is by lessening oppression in one area and then increasing oppression in another area.
Correct.
Yeah. So, of course, the subscribers of the counter letter clearly do believe that in order for some minorities to not be oppressed, you need to shift, you need to pass the boulder on to people who have not carried it for a while. And that only, of course, changes dynamics of oppression. That doesn't quite solve anything. The argument at the very core is, of course, the notion of free speech.
Right.
And both parties have a very interesting notion of what this entails, because we do have a feeling that the Harper's letter tries to advocate for discourse in a vacuum.
Okay, that's an interesting way of framing it. I see your point there.
So in which many of his signatories, such as J.K. Rowling, have encountered backlash in the social world.
Right.
J.K. Rowling certainly believes that this should not be a thing, even though she herself practices it upon people who tend to displease her.
Right.
Even to the point of sicking lawyers onto them. So we have, in this case, we have a bit of a double standard here, in which you have freedom of speech for some people, but up to a certain point, then that's where the line gets drawn.
I think also, as you said, the lines are blurred, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they vaguely allude to editors getting fired. The assumption is they are referring to James
Bennett.
The Cuomo
Bennett.
Piece, yeah. Yeah,
The
cotton piece, yeah. James, what's this? I keep wanting to call him James Ballard. James Bennett stepped down. The presumption is he was fired after the New York Times ran a
propaganda piece, basically.
It wasn't just, I mean, the problem is that piece is paywalled, right?
Yeah.
Which I think is really, really, like, it's a wrong on top of a wrong by the Times. They should make that available to everyone so they can judge for themselves. However, it is a piece, I wish I was joking, that advocates turning the American military on the Black Lives Matter protesters.
Mm-hmm.
By a, what is he, a senator?
A senator,
yeah,
I believe.
Yeah, he's a senator. And James, what's his name again? Bennett, James Bennett, this is why I make notes, he didn't get into trouble because it was an unpopular opinion. He got into trouble because he admitted he didn't read the piece before he published it.
Uh-huh.
So this isn't a free speech issue. This is a dereliction of duty issue. What he did was irresponsible.
That is pretty much, I'm sorry, if you're an editor signing off on a piece, you need to read it.
Well, especially when it contains disinformation, falsehoods, and outright slander against groups. I am no fan of Antifa, but there is no, I'm not even going to repeat the claims against Antifa because I never say it properly. They say Antifa, but there is no evidence that Antifa engages in the stuff that Tom Cotton accused them of. That can get a newspaper sued, even in an opinion section.
Mm-hmm.
Because anything like
the only reason it didn't get sued is because, of course, Antifa is not an organized group.
Correct.
Does not have a set leadership. So, of course, I guess Cotton felt that he could get away with that because, you know, there is no such thing as the chief executive office of Antifa who could, you know, put in a lawsuit.
Yeah, but I mean, Cotton is really, really towed the line on incitement to immediate incitement to violence.
Oh yes,
it was
an awful piece.
Yeah, and that is not protected speech. Like, that's the other problem I have with the open letter is that it doesn't acknowledge that there are limits on free speech. There always have been. They are different from country to country. The U.S. has a particularly open view on speech, but even the U.S. has very, very clear limits, even though some people think they actually aren't that clear. Mm-hmm. You can't incite to panic. You can't incite to riot. You can't incite imminent harm to somebody. And this is the concern with views like those of J.K. Rowling, that she is frightening people regarding trans women to the point, I believe, it is reasonable to be afraid that someone is going to get hurt based on J.K. Rowling's fear-mongering. Like, that is the problem I have with what she's doing. Now, no one can really stop her because we don't, you know, especially in the U.S., there aren't adequate, in my opinion, protections for trans people yet. But I mean, and sorry, she's British as well. So the British system is weird from my Canadian point of view. I'm not sure as a Canadian citizen, she could get away with what she wrote. She might get into a lot of trouble. We have pretty, pretty robust protections here. Now, some people claim that, oh, that means that Canada is, you know, an oppressive socialist suppressor of free speech. When in fact, if you actually look at what's going on here, we actually have in practice greater freedom of expression than a lot of other countries in the world. You know, people have the ability to say some utterly repellent things in Canada without government persecution. There's a weird case right here that a monument to Ukrainian military division that was at one point part an extension of the SS. Mm-hmm. So they were a Nazi regiment. There is a memorial to them on private property in, I believe it's Halton region, but I could be wrong. But no one's quite sure what to do about it because it's on private property.
Private property.
Yeah. Big, big oppressors of individual freedoms right up here in Canada. Everybody's like, what do we do? You know, it no one is quite sure what to do. And that is a tiny microcosm of the times we are living in, I believe. Let me test this out on you, Mouse.
Mm-hmm.
The issue right now is not that we are suddenly having a sudden chilling of speech among people making tons of money writing, you know, pounding on keyboards for a living.
Right.
The issue is that we are getting into the very nuanced end zone of equality right now, that there has been a lot of social change relatively quickly in terms of like a blink in human history. And it's not that the majority of people don't want to do the right thing. We just don't know what the right thing is because we are hitting a point culturally where we've never been before, right? We don't have perfect equality, but we're closer than we ever have been, at least in, you know, at least in our relatively free countries. There has been a backlash to that, but that is in part, I believe, because we are in uncharted territory. We are trying to figure this out as we go. And too many people who claim to be spokespeople for equality, they are spokespeople for a concept, and yet use this sort of leaderless structure. So they come out with some really bad ideas, or in the popular lexicon now, bad takes. And bad actors use that. Bad faith arguments use that, use the bad argument for equality as an argument that equality is actually not equality at all. And we're in a spiral. We've sort of lost, we're collectively suffering a case of cultural vertigo, because there's so much speech and so much media and so much is bombarding us on a daily basis that not only are people overwhelmed, but they don't have time, or they don't have the energy to check if something's true. And so they're just perpetuating stuff. They're sharing stuff that basically just confirms their pre-existing beliefs. And anybody who doesn't agree is evil.
Yeah, that we do have. It's one of the problems of having such a prolific media.
Yeah.
And it is that the human attention span. I have seen several studies that do point to the fact that our attention span, even our willpower, is right. A finite resource on the day to day. We do seem to expend a certain amount of energy and a certain amount. Decisions and conflict take an emotional toll.
Yes.
By the end of the day, a person is less likely, depending on the intensity of their day, is less likely to make as clear and nuanced decisions as they may have been at the beginning of the day. So if you factor in all of the avalanche of the news cycle, mm-hmm. of social media, mm-hmm. etc., we kind of have a scenario in which you have people that may not be giving themselves time for their brains to breathe, for their minds to grasp, instead of introspecting, mm-hmm. instead of chewing on the material, mm-hmm. on the developments, they are basically stripping the skin. I know this is a completely, this is the worst kind of imagery, because it doesn't work like that, because the brain's not built like that, but it's kind of like they're stripping off the skin of their brains, and it's all raw nerve, and it's all reaction.
You know, I know that's not how the brain works, but that is what it feels like.
Mm-hmm.
That's an accurate...
If your brain were your body.
Yeah. I mean, you can get overloaded. You can get overstimulated. You can get traumatized. That is fact. I mean, I went through a situation this week where somebody I know posted something very racist, and this mm-hmm. happened a few days ago, and I'm still affected by it. You know, there's this psychic static in my brain right now that I have not processed yet. So that's very real, you know? And I think we're all sort of torn between wanting to do the right thing, wanting to be on the side of justice and goodness and fairness, and yet at the same time, we're all exhausted.
Mm-hmm. I mean, aside from the fact that Trump and company have turned the United States political sphere into a goddamn circus.
Yes.
We also do have a pandemic that has killed more than 100,000 people. Of course, the number is much greater, but I think that 100,000 is a pretty horrifying mark.
In the U.S. alone.
In the U.S. alone.
Yeah.
We're number one. Yay.
Yeah. I think that particular point too is why I went so hard on, you know, a pox on both your houses kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Because now you decided to do this now, like you're arguing that people should be able to essentially spread disinformation now when
without consequences.
Well, when the U.S. is struggling to get at a coherent public health message because people don't trust the messaging coming out of public health departments because of a polarized political environment. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm like, why now? Why did you decide to do this now? I mean, I've noticed a decided correlation between people who are very politically polarized and an unscientific frame on the world. The same person that dropped the racist thing, I also got into a fight with because he believes wearing masks are anti-freedom, but he doesn't believe that abortion rights should be allowed. Like this is, and I bring this guy up because his family is very highly placed in conservative Christian circles. So this is not just some uneducated bumpkin, which is what we tend to dismiss people like this. This is a person of means, from a family of means. And it's almost like the richer you get now, the dumber you sound the minute you open your mouth.
Well, in many cases, you have people who have grown up with here's the thing. You'll remember the Ayn Rand, take a shot, people.
Right.
The Ayn Rand essay, Philosophy, Who Needs It? Where she talks about in the absence of a coherent rational philosophy, a person is left to essentially absorb his or her view of the world through social osmosis. Mm-hmm. And the resulting of that is a self-contradictory mess that remains unexamined, because of course a person is not practicing introspection. So in this case, you have this extremely, extremely fundamentalist type of view in the world, which is an authoritarian religion that demands you to accept its viewpoints based on faith and mm-hmm. not reason. Mm-hmm. And that will carry over, basically, once that foundation is set in, that's going to carry over into how a person acts and reacts to the world. People say, of course, oh, ideas aren't really that important, philosophies aren't that important. No, they are.
They are the stuff
out of which you are made. When you have a set of core beliefs, you're going to act on them. And if those mm-hmm. beliefs are contradictory or do not allow for questioning, you're not going to be a person who questions, am I arriving at the right conclusion? Mm-hmm. You're going to go, well, this is what my father or my family or the society tells me to do. That must be the right thing. So you end up believing such incredibly, stupidly contradictory things, such as the issue with abortion rights, and then you've got masks, apparently. And of course, you have those people who say, well, I don't need a mask because God will protect me. Okay, well, why do you need a gun then?
There you go. And they'll say that's different. And yet, they only believe it to be different because their underlying philosophical principles are fairly weak. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, I mean, we're talking about this at the same time as it's been quite a week. It's been quite a week in terms of John Lewis and C.T. Vivian passed away within 24 hours of each other. The fact that more people didn't know who C.T. Vivian was made me kind of sad. Especially in religious circles, but we're back to that. But then Joy Reid, it was announced, is getting Chris Matthews' old 7 o'clock spot on MSNBC. And this is very important because it's a black woman in early primetime news. Now, NBC mm-hmm. already has Lester Holt on the network side, but this is a black woman in early primetime in cable news. That's a very important benchmark. I would argue mm-hmm. that in many ways is even more important than, say, the election of Barack Obama. But then we have Nick Cannon going off about how black people are the real Jews, and he lost his job for it. Actually, he didn't lose his job for that. He lost his job because he wouldn't apologize for that.
Right.
And ironically, the smartest thing I have read all week on this whole culture war mess it was in the Atlantic, but it was by an ESPN reporter who herself had to recognize that she is also Black, had some wonky opinions that came from her family about Jewish people that she never questioned until her Jewish friends went about it. And, you know, she talked about the fact that anti-Semitic hate crimes are on the rise. This mm-hmm. is a real problem. And unfortunately, a lot of the stereotypes about Jewish people make people turn away from the seriousness of that problem. A lot of people, when they think of Jews, and this is awful, and I say this as a person who keeps kosher, when people think of Jews, they think of Harvey Weinstein and people like that. And, you know, Woody Allen. And yeah, stereotypes every so often are true in certain individual cases. But they don't think of, you know, the people who lost their lives in that Pittsburgh synagogue shooting. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem, is that people other each other. And they don't realize that words can have a domino effect. Words can incite. When you are dehumanizing anyone, you are committing harm. And I don't think any free speech principle anywhere gives people the right to dehumanize other people. That the buck has to stop somewhere. You know what I'm saying?
Well, as Voltaire said, I may not agree with what you have to say, but I will defend your right to say it. However, here's the thing. When we encounter, and this is what the letters are arguing against, which I find very, very strange. Mm-hmm. When we encounter something of that caliber going on in the public sphere, it behooves us to step up and use our freedom of speech
yes.
to combat that. It right. is not... It is not, okay, I'm going to call the government on you because you just said something I think is objectionable.
Or I'm going to call your employer on you or something. Although I think even in some cases there, that's okay, depending
that's
on
fair.
The transgression. Yeah.
For example, there was a case of a man, I think it was at a Walmart or a Costco, one of those places, mm-hmm. Where an elderly woman asked, he basically called him to the fact that he wasn't wearing a mask.
Right.
And he became an absolute troglodyte at her. It came to light that this man was an insurance advisor, an agent. And here's the thing. This, you know, that this now it comes to the nuanced
right.
part of this type of reaction. If this man were someone who was in a warehouse in the background, dealt absolutely with no customers,
right.
I might say, okay, I'm going to talk to him. I'm going to tell him to cut the shit out.
Right.
Because I don't want to see it.
Right.
And give him a chance to maybe clean up his act.
Right.
However, this is a man who is selling insurance to people. In this case, as a business owner, I would say, you know, after showing his colors, how can I be sure that he is actually giving my customers a good deal or treating them
equal treatment.
Oh, yeah. Equal treatment because, you know, they might ask him to wear a mask.
Well, that was my same argument about Amy Cooper. I mean, I know the guy who took that video, whose last name was also Cooper, Christian Cooper, didn't think she should lose her job, but she worked in some sort of investment group, knowing the awful history when it comes to America, Black people, mm-hmm. credit,
redlining,
banking system. She should not be in a job where she has any ability to influence who gets credit and who doesn't, who gets invested in and who doesn't. That's just disqualifying. That is as disqualifying as, say, a doctor who does not believe in the safety and efficacy of, you know, a measles vaccine.
Or the most recent the most recent ruling that allows for medical physicians, medical doctors and ambulance drivers, etc., to deny medical care to trans individuals, which I think is absolutely atrocious. There's also the things of the office which you occupy. If you are a doctor, you make you swear an oath.
Yeah.
It's either the Hippocratic Oath,
yeah,
or I forget his name. It's a doctor who rewrote the oath in the 70s, and it's actually pretty good. He had a funny name too, but I can't remember it. Lasagna. His last name is actually Lasagna.
His last name is Lasagna?
Yes, Dr. Lasagna's Oath.
Awesome.
I know. I said to Asher, if only his first name had been Garfield, it would have been perfect. But, you know, the Hippocratic Oath has weight. You are.
Oh, yeah, Louis Lasagna. You're right.
Yeah, Louis Lasagna.
Okay, Louis Lasagna. What a name. Yeah, okay.
I know. He could have given Chef Boyardee a run for his money.
Yeah, he's in the wrong business.
I know. But, you know, the Hippocratic Oath means that you are going to provide medical assistance no matter who is involved. Likewise, for example, if you are in a government position, like, I forget her name now, woman who did not want to issue wedding licenses to
county clerk.
Yes,
yeah.
to gay and lesbian couples. Well, I'm sorry, sweetheart, but for example, you are a county clerk. Your religion bears no fact in the carrying out of your duty. And if at one point you thought that would be an issue, then you should resign. You are in the wrong position.
It always baffles me how many members of both political extremes think the individual has the right to use the powers of the state to inflict their will on other people.
Yeah, pretty much.
I mean, private institutions, well, go on. Sorry, we'll get to this. Yeah. We'll get to the distinction in a minute because I think it's important.
Yes. And so I do believe that in these circumstances, when an employer has... when an employee has demonstrated such awful and abhorrent behavior in the public sphere, as a business owner, you do have the right to say, I do not wish to be associated with this person. I don't want this person to be associated with my firm, with my business. They are attracting attention to themselves in public and behaving in a way that I believe is contrary to the principles and the stated principles of the company that I founded, the company that I represent. That is not, here's the thing. There is no such thing as freedom of speech without consequence.
Yeah. If I had a nickel for the number of gaming publications who won't publish my stuff because I'm quote unquote too polarizing, I wouldn't have to work. So yeah, you take, there are consequences to doing what is wrong and doing what is right.
Yeah.
Because some people are not as far ahead as you.
Everything has a cost. Everything comes at a cost, with both good and bad. And so the great problem is that on one side, you have people who believe that there should be no such consequences, that everything should come down to a pat on the wrist and a there now.
Yeah.
And then you have on the other side people who believe that every offense should be a call to arms, go for the jugular.
Yeah, we're in a very punitive time.
And it's
weird. We're in a very punitive time socially, and yet the prison reform movement is trying to make us less punitive. It's incompatible because philosophical first principles are not aligning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's what happens when you live in a society that has decided to live more by emotion and, in many cases, postmodernist thought than any actual rational discourse.
Now,
especially when you have...
Sorry, go ahead. Finish your thought.
Especially when, as I have heard some people argue, which, of course, makes me a little bit tetchy, the notion of things like logic and reason, some people consider that to be actually a colonialist frameworks.
Yeah.
When those people say that to me, say, well, no, that is not true because you speak as if the Western countries are the only ones who have ever come up with such notions. You have examples of the Aztec and the Maya, for example, developing highly sophisticated logical and mathematical disciplines. And you have that, for example, also among certain African tribes. Of course, Africa has had in its history had the issue of scarcity, which encouraged nomadic living. But you see in those time periods where there was abundance and people could settle in more, you had the development of, you know, more sophisticated frameworks because people weren't trying to struggle to, you know, to survive every day.
Well, it's like the, what is it? The seven great inventions of historical China, eight, like gunpowder, writing, currency. Yeah. Like this isn't like the idea that logic is colonial is so very racist.
Among many, for example, among many, many things, and of course this is something...
The Arabic scholars in the Dark Ages, for God's sake. Well, they called it the Dark Ages for a reason.
Our Dark Ages. When Western Europe was in the Dark Ages, the Arabic Empire was flourishing. You had the Abbasid Caliphate. The only reason we have Aristotle today is because the Arabic cultures saved Aristotle's writings.
Absolutely.
And added commentary on them. And of course, you had all the mathematical and the lens work that happened in the Arabic world when basically in Europe they were drinking wine out of their opponent's skulls.
In Africa,
for example, you had in Africa you had a level of metalwork and smithcraft that surpassed. Either European level at the time. So
The Nubian dynasty in Egypt.
Yeah.
Like those were Africans before the modern concept of Africa existed. But this sort of brings me to one of the fundamental assumptions I talked about regarding the original letter that actually disturbs me. And this is a tale as old as time, but that's my whole point. Is so-called cancel culture new? It's not. You go back to, you know, the Greeks and drinking hemlock.
Or ask Anne Hutchinson.
Yeah, well, and I mean, the one that I think a lot of people have forgotten about, I mean, the first person who jumped to mind for me was Fatty Arbuckle, Josephine Baker.
Yes.
You know, I'm not going to get into it, guys. If you don't know who Fatty Arbuckle and Josephine Baker are, please read up on them. You'll thank me for it.
Yes.
But Ellen DeGeneres is an interesting case study in this because Ellen DeGeneres, in her lengthy by Hollywood standards, but again, in this scheme of human history, fairly short existence in popular culture, has gone from a degenerate to a heroic figure to an abusive boss. People just can't seem to figure out. Sorry, it went from... the hero to just somebody that everybody liked, and now there's this sort of backlash to Ellen's, like, nicey-nicey, let's dance, you know, with suburban housewives thing. But people forget that when Ellen dared to take her platform on a sitcom and say the words, I'm gay, to, I believe it was Laura Dern, she paid an incredibly heavy price.
Yeah.
She spent a lot of time in the career wilderness. There are a lot of plausible arguments that part of the reason that Michael Jackson's reputation was so put through the meat grinder was because he was an incredibly influential Black entertainer. People have been quote unquote being canceled for a while. The thing is now...
I mean, Eartha Kitt.
Yes,
come on.
Yes, Eartha Kitt. I mean, people like, what? There's a reason Aretha Franklin wrote checks to civil rights movements, right? The thing we're dealing with now is because we opened up music. The idea of Black music and white music started getting dismantled, and Black culture and white culture. You know, I don't think it's an accident that we're having this pearl-clutching debate at the same time that Blackish has two spinoffs going right now. I mean, we haven't seen a cultural force like that since, you know, the All in the Family Maude Jefferson phenomenon.
Yeah.
You know, TV that primarily makes people laugh, but also says something, also does social commentary and social reflection, that always makes people uncomfortable. There is always a desire to pull back power by the various cultural elites, be it, you know, a paper of record or an academic institution, when comedians and sitcoms and entertainment for the masses starts influencing people. You know what I'm saying?
It's the, you've gone too far.
Yeah, you the Oscar Wilde, you go too far, that accusing somebody of murder is worse than actually murdering someone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's important, because now I said I wanted to talk to this before we went on air, and we've been going for like almost an hour, and we're finally getting to it. But there's a real tempest in a teapot surrounding one of the signatories of the original open letter, and that's Barry Weiss. Mm-hmm. And Barry Weiss is another example. And I would, there's no comparison here, but I would lump her in with someone like an Ayn Rand, who, she is not the right kind of woman. And so people, instead of tackling her ideas, are trying to assassinate her character. They both committed sort of the sin of likability. I was kind of stunned, having gone through the whole, you know, women's studies post-secondary experience, to find out just how character assassinated Ayn Rand was, mm-hmm. by the left. And I think it's because people come to Ayn Rand through games like Bioshock, through comics like Watchmen by way of Mr. A, and they don't actually read the source material.
Rorschach. Mr. A wasn't in Watchmen.
No, that's what I mean. Like, Rorschach was Alan Moore going, here's why Steve Ditko's wrong on Mr.
Yeah.
A. Yeah. Like, it's so meta at this point. This is the thing. We are looking at the world through reflections of shadows.
Yes.
It's no wonder we can't grasp first principles. And this is sort of what's happened. Like, I go back and I watch The Wrath of Khan, and I know I'm going down a massive rabbit hole and apparently jumping all over the place, but I actually am chaining things together. You go back and read Watchmen, or watch The Wrath of Khan. And even then, within my lifetime, films, comic books, like, this is a science fiction movie and a graphic novel, okay? They assumed a much greater level of literacy in their reader than we can now. I mean, uh-huh. The fact that The Wrath of Khan was invoking things like Milton's Paradise Lost, they could reasonably believe that a large enough chunk of the audience were aware of the books on Khan's bookshelf early in that movie to get what they were doing on that level. You cannot assume that anymore.
No.
We are living in an age where people are attacking the guy who played Gus Fring in Breaking Bad, Giancarlo Esposito, for not being Latino enough to play a fascist, brutal dictator. This is what postmodernism has wrought. I talked to somebody who works at Ubisoft, was pretty upset at that. For people who don't know, it's a video game that is basically dealing with a combination of sort of Mexico City and Cuba under Castro. And I said to him, man, if you cast, like, they do cast a Latino as his son. And of course, these are the people that don't even say Latino, even though they're referring to as cisgendered men. They say Latinx, which, I don't know how you feel about this, Mouse, but a lot of Latin people I know don't like the term Latinx, but it's being forced upon them.
I'm honestly not very keen on that, because it's just such a language soup. If you want to be gender neutral, you can use Latin.
You notice I say Latin. I say Latin out of consideration for the people I know who are from Latin America who don't like Latinx, because that's what listening means. But
yes. Here's the thing. People will say, well, they'll confuse it with the Roman language. It's like, no, that is disingenuous. No, there are no ancient Romans left. No. Not a single person in the world is going to think that you're talking about a centurion when you say Esposito is Latin.
Nobody thinks the Roma are Italians either, okay?
Exactly.
Like, oh my God. And this is the problem with postmodernism, right? So people are taking... If you've seen Breaking Bad, or Better Call Saul, Giancarlo Esposito plays the horribly icy, drug-running chicken joint owner, Gustavo Fring. Giancarlo Esposito himself is half black. His mother was an African-American opera singer. His father was Italian. He was born in Denmark. He speaks Spanish. He learned to speak Mexican Spanish for Breaking Bad. His inclusion in this game placed in a fictional island. It is not in Cuba. It is not in Latin America. It is not in Mexico City. It is a fictional place. His inclusion in that fictional island is clearly because of his role on Breaking Bad. But also, why are people arguing that a culture that is the product of the Spanish conquest of Latin American indigenous peoples be represented or be included in a character who is so cold and messed up that he puts a live hand grenade in his own son's hand and tells him to hang on? Like, we have lost the plot when this is what people are getting outraged over.
Yeah.
Right. Meanwhile, Laura Bailey is voicing black South Africans and characters with the last name Diaz in various video games, and nobody says a peep. It's selective outrage, right? And that's where I circle back into Barry Weiss. Barry Weiss has a very complicated history. I don't know about you, Mouse, but the hatred for this woman that most regular people are profoundly unaware of is very interesting. It's almost as if she is one of these figures that came out of, for lack of a better term, cancel culture, tried to shake it and sort of go straight or go legit, and they won't let her leave. That's the only thing that makes sense to me. Because the vitriol surrounding this woman, because she has opinions that are not sufficiently quote-unquote left on the state of Israel. There are other people with similar views on the state of Israel that don't catch the same crap that Barry Weiss does. Do you have any insight into the phenomenon? Because why this is important is Barry Weiss resigned from, what publication was she at? I want to say the New York Times. But
don't remember exactly.
But anyway, she left her high profile associated editor role, claiming basically a toxic work environment, and her own coworkers, her own colleagues were calling her a Nazi and blacklisting people who were nice to her because of her views, because of her writings. None of this is proven, but this is her claim. And personally, Mouse, feel free to disagree with me here, but I think that her claims are more serious and worthy of investigation than any of these open letters flying around.
Yeah, and for starters, we have a name and we have events that are being alleged, as opposed to the very nebulous, I will tell you about what happened, but not really tell you what happened.
Right.
Who are we talking about or what's involved?
Yeah.
That in and of itself, you know, you already have more, a greater ability to get material evidence than simple, than floating allegations.
She's making very specific claims in a specific workplace in a specific time. We can investigate this. She's actually putting her credibility on the line here. And I give her credit for that.
Yeah.
You know, Andrew Sullivan walked too, and Andrew Sullivan's another kind of controversial figure. in that he's another one that has some funny opinions on race and genetics and things like that. But he's also, you know, an HIV positive gay man, which is supposed to mean something in this world, you know? So there's been sort of tumult right now. And apparently Andrew Sullivan's claim is that they didn't want him writing about Black Lives Matter. I don't know about you, Mouse, but in that case, I kind of agree with his bosses on that one, because he's not going to get a fair hearing. You know, there is a time where you got to learn when to shut up and recognize it is not your turn. Not because you are being silenced, not because you're letting them win, but because you, with your track record, not you, Mouse, I'm using the royal you, Andrew Sullivan, I'll be specific, Andrew Sullivan, with his track record, will just destabilize things even more. It is not his time to talk about this particular issue. And I could say that about so many flipping people right now.
It's all about the appropriate person at the appropriate time.
Right.
You know, the golden mean.
Yeah, and people believe that's censorship. And that's not. That's wisdom. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And censorship, let's be honest, people, censorship only comes from the government. When someone tells you, I don't want you to write about this, or I don't want you on my platform anymore, please leave. It's not censorship. It's people exercising the rights of association. Of course, there is a difference in the register, in the level at which it is engaged.
Yes.
There's a difference between asking someone, you know, please leave, this is unacceptable, I will not condone this, and essentially turning into a raging maelstrom and just escalating things to the point that nobody is hearing you, hearing your objections, because you have decompensated so much.
Mm-hmm.
That is also a concern. You have the right to exercise your right to association and to tell a racist idiot, you know, go, you can leave now.
Yeah.
But you also have to remember that you can be in the most upsetting of situations, but you must remain in some modicum of control of yourself, not just because it is an optics thing, but more importantly, when you're in that position, when you are in the face of something that is upsetting you,
mm-hmm.
something that absolutely revolts you,
mm-hmm.
you are emotionally vulnerable.
Yes.
You're in an emotionally vulnerable location. And to try and maintain control of yourself is not doing this for the benefit of others. Although how you conduct yourself is something that people will talk about.
Yes.
But ultimately, it is a means of taking care of yourself.
Yeah. It and people are going to say that some of the things we're saying here are contradictory. They're not. I think that part of the problem with, we've talked about the over-education of the West before, but personally, whenever I hear these, you know, left-wing publications, and the right-wing has their own elitist blather in mm-hmm. terms of language, in terms of coding. The minute that, like, Latinx is an example. The minute I see that, I'm like, I know who you're speaking to. You're not speaking to the masses. You're speaking to a very targeted crowd. You are trying to ingratiate yourself to the people you're afraid of. In that, those are signifiers, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why when I experience as a total outsider to the phenomenon, I have no skin on what we call black brown people from Mexico and South and Central America, except I have friends. But that's my whole role there. Like, what do my friends, what do my colleagues feel most comfortable being called? And I am going to listen to the people I immediately interact with and give you guys respect instead of trying to cater to a faceless mob because they may get angry at me on Twitter. Mm-hmm. You know, like that's just that is humanity to me. Who are these people on Twitter that I will interact with once? They are nobody to me. Why would I dishonor the people that I know to be good people who have given me something? Why would I dishonor them to appease people I don't know? Like, I won't even say I barely know them. I don't know them. I don't even know if a Twitter account is a real person, right? Or that they're the person they claim to be on Twitter. So why are they relevant to me? Oh, well, they might cancel me, you know? And I don't know your take on cancel culture, Miles. I realize we haven't actually talked about this ever. Maybe we can land on this, but people have tried to cancel me. Milo Yiannopoulos tried to cancel me. Hasan Piker from the Young Turks has tried to cancel me. The acolytes of Jordan Peterson have tried to cancel me. The rabid fans of The Last of Us 2 have tried to cancel me. Do you see a pattern here that
yes.
The right giveth, the left taketh away, right? I'm still going. I'm not famous, you know. I don't make a ton of money at this. But I have not had my livelihood taken away from me. There is a way to navigate the outrage that I think is not being given enough attention, because I think the reason that people are screaming about this so much is someone is rewarding someone for claiming victimization by the mob. And I mean, you've just dipped your toe into the insanity that comes on Twitter when people find out you have a podcast. you're new to this. You don't seem to care very much.
No, not really.
The reason you use pseudonyms is because of your other work.
Well, not even so much. To be honest, the reason I use pseudonyms is, for me, it's the convenience of compartmentalization.
Okay.
And by that, I mean, I like being able to publish just my opera content under my real name, and then to publish my art under, not because my art is horrible, because I don't draw. Unlike 99% of the furry artists out there, I actually don't draw porn.
Yeah. But I mean, you're using a performative persona like Lady Gaga or Nicki Minaj.
Kind of, but yeah. Also it's because it's a kind of a practical thing. Most opera singers, you know, like I'm going to say like 99% of them are not familiar with, that is changing a little bit because the demographic is younger, mm-hmm. gaining is actually a crossover with some of the younger opera singer friends that I have. You know, we do have that in common. I don't have that with the older ones. But for example, the comics, furry culture, online culture, stuff like that, most opera singers are kind of isolated in their own, somewhat more conservative. And by this, I mean conservative as far as subcultures go.
Right.
More conservative bubbles. So we don't have that in common. So I have, you know, I have my opera account, talk to my opera friends, and also a lot of opera singers can be very, very annoying. So because most of them just focus on being opera singers and they don't expand. I'm not like that. So I have my Mouse Marriages persona because I want, you know, because that's where I go and like I harass, not really harass. I go and like talk to Richard Garriott.
You fling Golden Girls memes at people.
I would fling Golden Girls memes at people.
Yeah.
I talk to game devs. Talk to writers, etc. Things that are outside of that professional sphere that don't really fit in that professional sphere. So it's not me trying to, because you know, you do just one very, very simple search and you know my name. I don't hide my name. It's more of along the lines of I have this, you know, I have this online account to do my professional opera work.
Right.
I have this to play, and I've got my Steam name for, you know, challenging people to speedrunners, whatever.
Yeah, it's the same way I use YouTube to do video game content, because I love video games, but I use this podcasting platform to talk more, you know, political, critical thinking, philosophical stuff. It sometimes you have to partition your plate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I have, in the past, I have run afoul of certain furries. It just sounds so strange to say that, doesn't it? But there was an issue with local furries here where there was some dodgy stuff going on, potentially. And I spoke out about it, and that got me railroaded by the mob.
Right.
One of the reasons I'm not actively part of the furry fandom is that I became very disenchanted once I saw just how much of back covering there was.
Yeah.
Of, you know, we're all accepting, so we're not going to talk about this thing that's going on.
Right.
And my husband and I were both, no, this is important. This could be potentially really bad. We
right.
need to talk about this now. And
right.
We got kicked out of the mailing list and the groups, etc.
Yeah.
And we went, okay, no skin off my nose.
Right.
Of course,
you moved on.
Yeah, did, of course, for several months. We had hordes of furries screaming at us on LiveJournal. That gives it a little bit of a date. This is before LiveJournal was acquired by the Russians. And so they were saying, well, we're going to call your employer and tell them about it. And I said, okay, go ahead and call them. My employers know.
The employers are going to be like, what? You're what? Like, he did
yeah.
what? What is what? You're using a bunch of words I don't understand right now. Like that's what happens when those things sort of break containment in that regard. It's mm-hmm. funny in that regard. I think that's also why Joy Reid's promotion this week is super important too, because people seem to forget with now that, you know, Black people matter again. I'm being mm-hmm. facetious there, but I am coming at this from a person who did gay rights outreach in a Black majority neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And I saw the homophobia that is, there are reasons that actually are connected to colonialism and forced conversions.
Yeah.
But, you know, Joy Reid was canceled for a while because an old blog of hers came out where she said some pretty awful stuff about gay men. And when it first came out, instead of admitting, you know, she's evolved and stuff, she tried to claim she was hacked. So she disappeared for
Never
a while.
Never do that, people. Just yeah. own up to your mistakes.
Yeah, she disappeared for a while. But she's an example. Like, I watched NBC, because she used to be the regular fill-in for Rachel Maddow, which mm-hmm. is an indication she was being groomed for greater things, right? You don't
right.
get that fill-in without that. And then that happened. Then the cancellation happened, and she disappeared from the fill-ins. It was everybody but Joy Reid for a while filling in for Rachel Maddow.
Mm-hmm.
And then you saw them kind of testing the fill-ins. She got to fill in for, you know, Chris Hayes for a while, which, you know, Chris Hayes and Rachel Maddow are very, very, very different programs.
Yes.
But certainly Chris Hayes is not considered as prestigious as Rachel Maddow's slot just because of sheer ratings, even though he's the lead-in. But, you know, they tested it and they tested it and they tested it. And eventually in the wake of the George Floyd stuff and a very sudden and dramatic cultural shift in terms of who is the show pony of the moment, and people may be offended by that, but I'm sorry, it's true. She got her status back. On the one hand, I'm happy for that. On the other, I don't want anyone to confuse, you know, the Nick Cannons and the Joy Reids and you know, the various leaders, you know, the people who number upon the elites, and, you know, Joy Reid rubs elbows with Robert De Niro and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's a totally different world. That's a totally different Black American experience than the majority one. And I think too many people point to success stories like that, subconsciously wanting to avoid the fact that those people defied the odds, as opposed to being, you know, they're
exceptions. An example of, yeah.
Yeah.
They're as opposed to being the common American story, which they're not.
Yeah. And I'd like Joy Reid to lay off Ayn Rand, because she uses Ayn Rand as a punching bag. I'll be happy when the Madeleine Albright, "There's a Special Place in Hell for Women Who They Don't Help Other Women," quote, comes back in vogue. I was very sad when that sort of disappeared, because there is some real truth to that. And that, this is what I felt like, not felt, thought. Oh God, I hate it when I do that. When people do that, I did it myself. Ah, I caught myself thinking, not feeling on this
podcast.
All right.
You need to atone. You have to say 4 Hail Marys and 3 Hello Dollies.
Really? Not 4 Hello Dollies and Hello Mary. There we go. I combine them into one.
There you go.
But this is a thing that's getting lost on both sides of this open letter debate, is that we do have issues of, like I said, like postmodern show ponies at any given time. Right now, Latin American, like Chicano, various immigrant sort of experiences to America are kind of having a rising moment at the same time and kind of competing with Black Lives Matter, et cetera. And I think that has only highlighted the absolute underrepresentation of these groups in intellectual media, hear the air quotes in my voice.
Yeah.
If it weren't for things like hip hop, reggaeton, the fashion industry, people like Robert Rodriguez starting like the El Rey Network, the underrepresentation would be far worse. Like people like Jay-Z became CEOs, started creating jobs for other people. You know, black people are now owning NBA teams instead of just playing in the NBA. Mm-hmm. This stuff's all really important, but the fact that the gay rights movement and more, you know, the sort of schism in the sort of LGBTQ plus umbrella is showing there are people that ascend faster than other groups of people. And who that is no accident, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can think of like how many black men had to die before George Floyd versus how many Ellens did we have to have before that took off, right? And that creates a real problem for people who have intersectional identities that they might be, heaven forbid, you know, Latino and gay or black and
Latino
trans.
And black.
Yeah.
Or Latino and black, which black, a lot of
Hispanic.
People forget is a thing.
Yep. Yeah, well, I mean, everybody cheers Miles Morales and then acts like black Hispanics are not a thing, right?
Yeah, I know.
It's so strange. Like, we have these blind spots, and those people, that trans lady that very meekly asked me to talk about this, those are the people that are getting left out of these highly intellectualized sophist solipsism arguments. None of these people, despite their protests, are really considering the impact that their activism has on those people, right? Regular people just trying to get by. People who hold up black people and trans people as some, I don't know, fetish totem, you know, arguing against more open debate, are no better than J.K. Rowling, who is using the trans identity as a whipping post as well. They're all using it as a whipping post. It's an academic exercise for people. It's not real. It's not their reality. Even people who do have trans identities, if anybody cares if you put your name on something, your experience is not the norm.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I have to remember that every day because I've been doing this for half my life now. And for all the shit I take, it's a privilege to be able to come here and talk to people the way I do when, you know, I enjoy being able to introduce people to, you know, wonderful personalities like Mouse here. That is what I enjoy doing. I like being able to use my platform, you know, as modest as it is, to introduce new minds and new frames and new ways of thinking. I wish I could do so much more of that, because that is doing what these open letters don't. I don't think we mentioned this whole thing that the guy who organized the original Harper's letter, Thomas Chatterton Williams, is mixed race.
Yeah.
And that's what's so strange about this focus on whiteness in the counterattack. It's, and I know Mouse, I can hear the in your voice, that, but of course it was. I know you're thinking that, but you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't think we should lose sight of how truly bizarre and odd and illogical and how not the norm it is.
Yeah.
You know, because you then listen to people like C.T. Vivian and John Lewis, and you listen to their rhetoric, and you look at what they actually accomplished with their lives and what they were willing to put on the line, and you listen to their rhetoric, you know, compared to these pissants who won't even put their name on a letter. They put their company's name on a letter instead of their name, because everybody's playing the, oh, who is it? You know, who is it that at NBC News, that it actually gives them more status as opposed to less, because it's not the who. And full disclosure, I should say, I actually know a couple of the people who signed the original Harper's letter. Mm-hmm. And they're good people. And they have, it's interesting, one of the people on that letter, her story is very similar to that of Ayn Rand, as, you know, her family fled Russia. And it impacted a lot of their views. But I hope that the messages of action that came from men like C.T. Vivian and men like John Lewis, and you know what, even people like Angela Davis now, mm-hmm. right? Messages of action instead of messages of anger. We can't let them be swallowed up because a bunch of collectivist yahoos know how to work a search engine. Right? Like, they know how to get hits. They know that enragement is engagement. They know how to get people chattering for a couple of weeks. People confuse the internet for what's really happening in the world, and it's left them very afraid.
Yes.
And that fear is making them not have an open heart to that lovely trans lady and people like her that asked me to do stuff like that. And this is why, I don't know about you, Mouse, but I personally keep sticking my neck out for this stuff, because I won't let that happen. Like, I can't let fear win. I can't let hate win. It may take me down with it, but at least I'll go down fighting, you know? Like, if guys like John Lewis can get beat up by cops for trying to cross a bridge, I can do a podcast.
Yeah.
You know? It's just, and what I wonder is why people like J.K. Rowling, who claim to love trans people, can't see things from a frame beyond her own. Because apparently, wow. isn't that in the three languages of politics? That the whole idea of persuasion is changing people's frames?
Yeah, it's to be able to basically move from one act, move the conversation, to register of the conversation from one axis to the other. Of course, the author, being libertarian, advises that really the best axis to land on is the liberty.
Is his versus, own.
Yeah, liberty versus authoritarianism, which, you know, from the point of view of a freer society, does make sense. But the hard part is that when you have level of emotional trauma, or you have a very difficult history, you tend to identify with the axis that you have engaged in the most.
Well, you also can't let one group's freedom come at the cost of another's.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the balance we're trying to find, right? Like, I don't want open internet arguments, like the right to fight on the internet, to supersede the right of a trans woman to feel safe using a public bathroom. You know, right. like let's get shit sorted here, people. Like, that's what we're talking about here, right? And I think we can close, be it resolve that it is possible to want and support free speech and also recognize that false evidence and ideas based on misinformation do not deserve guaranteed publication in papers of record.
Correct.
Okay. Awesome.
You have editorial discretion, and as a paper of notice, it behooves you more than anyone else to check sources and check facts before you allow anything to be published.
Right.
Because that is allegedly what you're there to do.
Yeah, you can't just say, I think this group of people is evil and dangerous and have that protected as your opinion. Like, no, yeah. It's not. You're couching what you believe to be facts in your opinion, but you're not, you notice this whole podcast, I have been very careful saying, in my opinion,
yes,
when it's not something I can back up. These are mm-hmm. theories in some cases. I mean, we float a lot of theories on this podcast, right? Because we're trying them out. We're seeing if they check out. We're actually taking first principles and experimenting to see if the logic holds, because if it doesn't, well, then we're
like
wrong.
Like in the experiment, it'll right. blow up.
That's right. We're wrong about our first principles if the logic doesn't hold. So everybody's probably really overwhelmed right now, which means it's time to wrap. This has been the Broken Clock Podcast. I almost said the Broken Clock Podcast.
it's better than some of the other flubs we've had before.
And yet it's such a Freudian slip with the cloddishness that we've been covering today.
I know.
But you're probably already aware of the FU Network if you're listening to this podcast. But funetwork.tv, the website, is undergoing some changes right now, but all the content's still there. Links to our Patreon, links to one-time PayPal donations. If you like this kind of content and you got the money to spend, put your money where your mouth is. There's no selfish motivation for me saying that at all, but Mouse, as usual, you have the last word.
Think clearly. Remember, try to keep a hold and control of yourself, because it is a way to keep you safe. And never, ever, ever sign a group letter without reading it all the way through.